Radio.
Arguments are not going to attract people. Winning is going to attract people.
Radio.
The Poor People's Riot, as they call it, was necessary, it was reasonable, and it was just.
Radio.
And if you get in my way to make sure that that man gets housing, or that he gets enough to eat, I will move you.
Radio. Okay.
Hello, this is 88.1 FM OCAP Radio, and I am Kelly Bentley, and I will be your host for tonight. This evening, I will be discussing various updates about what's going on in OCAP and other groups in the city, and then we will listen to a clip from Jackie Esmond talking at an event for the organization Health for All. Okay, so I'm going to go into some of these updates right now. Okay, our first update is organizing to defend poor communities. The East Downtown Toronto has a long history of poor people organizing in their communities around poverty. During the Depression, the unemployed in East Downtown Toronto organized to stop evictions, demanded work or relief, struggled for better hostel conditions, and they fought major battles around free speech. Since the mid-1990s, poor people in East Downtown Toronto organized massive demonstration against the Harris cuts to social services. During this period, poor people in East Downtown Toronto organized to stop cuts to welfare, demanded affordable housing by taking over abandoned buildings, set up special diet clinics in the area so that people on social assistance could get more money to feed themselves and their families, and organized around the gentrification of their neighborhoods. Today, more and more services are being removed from the East Downtown Toronto, and the poor are being driven out of the area. The economic crisis and the current national debt will put more pressure on services and on the poor living in East Downtown and other poor neighborhoods in Toronto over the next few years. How will people organize themselves today to fight against poverty and defend neighborhoods and services? What is the role of social agencies in this struggle? Can poor communities learn from past struggles? On Friday, March 26, community workers, anti-poverty activists, and poor people who live in East Downtown and throughout Toronto will gather to discuss the various ways in which they can begin to fight for basic needs and services and to defend the community. So what's going on is on Friday, March 26 at 6 p.m., there will be a public meeting and there will be a meal served. It'll be located at St. Luke's Church at 353 Sherbourne Street. That's at Sherbourne and Carleton. And if you want to come, show up. If you've got something to say, say something. And if you want more information, you can email eastfightback@gmail.com. Okay, so you, as a performer or interested individual, can help No More Silence in their fundraising drive by getting involved in three important fundraising and awareness events, which will be happening in Toronto during the month of June, being organized by Liza Hancock. No More Silence is a Toronto-based voluntary network striving to work at the grassroots level. They are Indigenous women and allies, activists, academics, and researchers with the purpose of raising awareness around state complicity in the murders and disappearances of over 500 Indigenous women on Turtle Island. They hold a rally every February 14th at the police headquarters in Toronto, and this year was their fifth year, and to draw attention to the issues that are linked around the disappearances of Indigenous women on Turtle Island, and they're also linked with other cities across Canada who hold services and rallies. What they do is, one, they educate themselves and others about Canada's colonial reality past and present and the resulting genocide. They explore and act on strategies to end inaction, impunity, injustice, and deliberate ignorance on the part of the state in Canada and internationally. And they work together as Indigenous women and allies to foster new forms of solidarity and a practice of decolonization amongst all people living on Turtle Island. So they're having three events. Those are still in the works, so I can't give you the exact details of them, but I know there will be performers, musicians, DJs, writers, poets, and they need lots of people to come out and be interested and help out with that process. And if you want to help Liza, you can email her at lizahololly@yahoo.com. And just so you know, that all the funds raised at these Toronto events will go as bursaries for young women who have been affected by murder or disappearances in their family to further their education. And our last final update is about what's going on in OCAP. So yesterday, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP Ottawa, and Ottawa's Under Pressure Collective basically took over Madeleine Milieu's office. And part of the reason for that is because, well, she's responsible for social services. So here we go. The Ontario government is looking to balance the budget on the backs of the poorest people in the province. They are intending to slash the special diet funding, a crucial source of income for over 162,000 people in Ontario. This benefit provides up to $250 a month per person to those on social assistance who are suffering health problems. One in five people on assistance rely on this money to be able to eat. Cutting this money will lead to a massive increase in hunger in the province, evictions, and long-term health consequences for people on social assistance. Since 2005, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty organized clinics staffed by doctors and nurses who believed that the allowance could provide essential support for people unable to live healthy on current welfare and disability rates. The largest clinic, held on the lawns of Queen's Park in 2005, signed up over 1,000 people. Welfare and disability payments need to be brought back to the level they were before Harris cuts to welfare in 1995. This requires a 40% increase. Without a raise of that level, the special diet funds are the difference between housing and the street, between sickness and health. What does losing the special diet mean to people's lives? It means not enough food to eat. It means continued health problems. It means losing housing. It means that the people on the street who get a very small pittance on welfare are going to get even less. So it looks like the provincial government is planning to cancel the special diet. We're probably going to find this out, I believe March 25th is the Ontario budget. This will mean that thousands of poor people in this province will be pushed into hunger, illness, homeless, and desperation, and this is unacceptable. And now is the time to tell your provincial politician and city politicians that to not let this happen. So what we're asking is for an email, a call around, a fax. To call particular people, which I'll tell you about, and demand that they maintain the special diet funding, to tell them that they can't cut costs by attacking those on social assistance and disability support programs, and to let them know that what is needed is a 40% raise in social assistance rates back to the level in the mid-1990s. So you can call, fax, or email Premier Dalton McGuinty. His office number is 416-325-1941. His fax number is 416-325-3745. And you can email him at dalton.mcguinty@premier.gov.on.ca. You can fax, phone, email Madeleine Milieu. She's the Minister of Community and Social Services. Her email is mmileur.mpp@liberal.ola.org. Her office number is 416-325-5225, and you can fax her at 416-325-5191. You can also fax, phone, and email Janet Davis, and she's the chair of the Council Committee responsible for social services in Toronto. Her office number is 416-392-4035. And her email is counselor_davis@toronto.ca. Her fax number is 416-397-9289. And finally, you can come out to our Raise the Rates mass demonstration on April 15th at 12 noon. We will be meeting at Allen Gardens, and that is located at the corner of Sherburn and Girard. So what's coming up next is we're going to have a little song from The Jam called Saturday's Kids. La 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 la. Saturday's boys live life with themselves. Drink lots of beer and wait for half-time results. Afternoon tea in the lighter by. Chat the girls, they dig it. Saturday's girls work in Tesco's and Woolworths. Wear cheap purple because they sell what they can afford. Go to Tesco's and do bacon sham. Talk to Jane, bingo accents. La 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 la
like the days kids play one-armed bandits. They never win, but it's not the point, is it? Dipping silver paper when their pants go flat. How about that? Mums and dads, no caps, do no filters. We're all paper lives, cause they all die of cancer. What goes on, what goes wrong? Save up their money for a holiday to Chelsea, Bill, or Brackish and May. Think about the future when they're settled down. And a girl next door with one on the way. These are the rare creatures that time has forgot, not given a thought. It's the system, hate the system, smash the system.
Hello again, this is 88.1 FM Radio, and I'm Kelly Bentley. So next we're going to listen to a clip, and it came from an event from Health for All, titled Fixing a Broken Healthcare System for Immigrant and Refugees. During this event, panelists spoke about the limits that refugees and people without status have in accessing healthcare. There were three speakers that night, and we will be listening to the panelist Jackie Esmond discuss many of the legal difficulties that refugee and persons without status face when trying to access health care in Canada. Jackie Esmond is a lawyer that has a thorough knowledge of immigration law, and now let's just listen in on her discussion.
Can you hear me? Is that okay? Okay. Well, I thought I'd start off with the story of a gentleman who I was working with a few years ago. I was contacted initially by a social worker from a community center who was trying to help a very sick man who had come to her for help. This was a man who was 65. He was originally from Jamaica, but he had been living in Canada since the 1960s, working on the trains. He worked for 40 years. He had a family. He paid his taxes. He bought property. He did everything that we all do in our everyday lives. And then he retired. And that's when he discovered that he didn't have status in Canada. He thought he did. He came here, he'd been working, he'd been doing everything that everybody else with status in Canada does. He'd been accessing health care. And he couldn't remember what happened 40 years ago when he initially came to Canada. He thought he had status. It turned out he didn't. It turned out that the health care he was getting was through private insurance that had been being provided by his employer for 40 years that ended with his retirement. So he found himself suddenly having to deal with status issues and very serious health issues. He had developed a serious heart condition that required surgery, and he was in no position to pay the private fees that would be required in order to get treatment. Now, he was shocked, the social worker was shocked to discover that as somebody who'd been a long-term resident of Canada, that he was not able to access health care. He'd been paying taxes all these years. But I'm sure almost all of you in this room know this story is far from unique. I'm sure it's something that many of you see very regularly in your work. And there are many terrible stories of gentlemen like that who were long-term residents, who become ill and who cannot access health care. There's once I was doing a lot of research before I came here. I was a bit intimidated by the my panelists who are so knowledgeable in this area. And I came across a study that found in 2007 they interviewed a number of workers, healthcare workers and providers in Quebec. And there was a coroner who spoke about that within the past year, he could identify at least four cases in which people had died because they had delayed accessing healthcare. Because they were not insured. They were immigrants and refugees, people who were long-term residents of Canada. Again, in preparing for this event, I thought I'd check out what Health Canada had to say about the issue. And I was initially pleasantly surprised to find that they have a whole section of their website that's devoted to what they identify as issues of healthcare accessibility, which is an area of research that they're conducting, and they had a series of reports that were dealing with what they called issues in equity and responsiveness in access to health care in Canada. So I thought, well, this is a good sign that Health Canada cares about some of the things that I care about too. And then I read some of the reports, and my pleasure turned to dismay. So let me me just show you one surprising conclusion that I read in some of the reports. Newcomers to Canada generally do not face barriers related to availability of services. Most are eligible for health care coverage on arrival, and for the past several years, even refugee claimants have emergency and needed health care service provided under the interim federal health program. Because many newcomers have lower incomes than the general population, they often face financial barriers to uninsured services. However, refugees are eligible for social assistance while they are seeking employment, and so are often covered for many non-assured health benefits. So at least this report was quite satisfied that issues of accessibility to health care is not a major issue in terms of for many immigrants and refugees to Canada. Instead, it focuses for the remainder of the report on issues of cultural difference and language as barriers to health care rather than some of the issues of that we'll be talking about today. So I'll try to cover in the time that I have. What I'll first talk about, since I'm Lauren, supposed to talk about the legal issues, I'll talk about how it is that we have what I would call a system of legalized discrimination against immigrants and refugees in this country. I will briefly address the issue of the federal interim health benefit that the report I just referred to suggests is some excellent replacement for access to OHIP and suggests that, in fact, it's far from a replacement for OHIP. And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about the ways in which our flawed immigration system actually creates categories of precarious status and ensures the presence of undocumented workers and people without status in Canada. And some of the reasons why I think we should all care about and support a campaign for health for all. So first of all, turning to legal barriers to medical care for immigrants and refugees. Now, we have something in Canada called the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. There's international law. There's a number of human rights documents that speak very clearly to that the right to health care is a right that is shared by everyone, and that is not something that should be based on your nationality, your country of origin, and so on. And yet, in Canada, we have a Canada Health Act that specifically provides that insurance, health insurance, is for people who are lawfully entitled to be or to remain in Canada. And it's the Canada Health Act, then, that is the ultimate source of the exclusion of many immigrants and refugees from access to health care in Canada. Now, the language, person lawfully entitled to remain in Canada, it's actually fairly broad. That could be interpreted narrowly, and that could be interpreted broadly to include large numbers of immigrants and refugees. And so you'll find that the way that plays out across the country can really vary. So each province has their own interpretation of what that means, and different definitions of who has legal status and who does not in terms of access to health care. And that, for me, is one key indicator that this is a very unprincipled system, if you can have that kind of variance across the country. Now, in Ontario, the way that that phrase is defined in the Health Insurance Act in Ontario, there are certain kind of categories of immigrants and refugees who can access health care. So obviously, if you're a citizen or you're a permanent resident, then you have access to OHIP. Then accepted refugees or protected people, what are called protected persons, have access to OHIP. People who have passed first stage approval, if they've applied within Canada for permanent residence, if they've passed first stage approval, then they can access OHIP. Certain people with certain types of work permits can also access OHIP, and certain temporary resident permits as well. So the access is actually fairly strictly defined, and it excludes many, many people who have been in Canada, some for many, many years. So there are many people who fall through the cracks of this narrow definition, and people who are failed refugee claimants but have applied for judicial review of that decision, people who have overstayed visitors' visas. There's just an infinite number of other categories of people who are excluded. But even those who fit into those narrow categories that I spoke about, even amongst those people, there are quite a number who still cannot access OHIP. The one major problem is that the process of transferring from one status to another within the immigration system in Canada is extremely bureaucratic, full of delays, a very inefficient system that punishes people. So there are many people who should be able to access OHIP, have the legal status as defined in the statute, but for reasons of administrative delay and bureaucracy are not accessing health care. The other problem, which I'm sure many people in this room are familiar with, is the issue of the three-month residency requirement in Ontario. So that is, you have to have lived in Ontario for 3 months before you can access the OHIP program. And this is a huge problem for newcomers, people who are newcomer residents in Canada, people who have just arrived on a work permit. They have to wait 3 months before they can access health care to the OHIP program. Now, this is not a requirement that is universal across Canada. There are four provinces that have this three-month delay, and New Brunswick, I believe, just last week announced that they are getting rid of that requirement. So that shows that this is something that can be done. I know there are a number of people who work really hard in advocating for getting rid of the three-month wait, and I think it's something that is possible in Ontario, especially with the example of New Brunswick. So those are the limitations of the OHIP program. In terms of what I was speaking of at the beginning, the interim federal health benefit, which is a health program that's run by the federal government, this is something that is available for, and I'll just define it really loosely, it's people who don't have formalized, regularized status in Canada, but are allowed to be here. They're allowed to be here. So that includes people like people who have applied for refugee status and haven't had it determined yet. So they're allowed to be here while that process is ongoing. It also applies to failed refugee claimants who are waiting. There's a whole number of stages to go through before somebody can be removed from Canada. And while that process is ongoing, then they can access the federal interim health benefit. There are a number of countries that are considered so dangerous that even Canada won't deport them back to those countries. So if you are people from those countries, they are also able to access this benefit. So there's a number of people who fall in this gray area where they don't have kind of formalized status, but they're allowed to be here. And they can access the interim federal health benefit. And it's this benefit serves approximately 95,000 people in Canada every year. Now, there are a number of problems with this benefit. It is by no means a replacement for OHIP. Some of the problems with it include it's limited to emergency and essential health care coverage only. And that what that means can be very unclear, both to patients and to medical professionals. So it's not uncommon for patients to feel as though they're dealing with a health emergency, to go for help, and then to get a bill months later, once the people who run this program decide that their health issue was not serious enough to warrant getting coverage under the program. The program doesn't cover routine examinations and treatment. It covers the cost of essential medications only. Ongoing mental health services are not covered by the program. It's a huge issue. We have many people coming from situations where they've experienced trauma and other types of issues, and they cannot access the kind of mental health services that they require under this program. There are lots of stories of practitioners who refuse to accept patients who have the interim federal health benefit. It's not always recognized by doctors and emergency room personnel. So I've just covered some of the problems. I'm sure that there are many practitioners who could identify many more, but it's far from a replacement for OHIP. There are many people, like I said, who are allowed to be here, but who live with this kind of second-rate health service for years and years. And I think that's something that really has to change. I'm told I have 5 minutes left. So now the impact on communities is something that is readily apparent. There was a study published by some physicians from the Volunteer Uninsured Immigrant and Refugee Clinic in Scarborough who said 46% of the patients that they saw were applicants who were living in Canada awaiting a decision on their immigration status. And 36% were accepted immigrants who were in that 3-month waiting period. The average length of time that patients had been in the country waiting for health insurance was 2 years, and at the high end it was decades.
That was Jackie Esmond speaking about the difficulties refugees and undocumented persons experience when trying to access health care. Now, due to time constraints, we weren't able to hear everything she had to say, and we weren't able to provide the other two panelists. But if you're interested, you can listen to the entire event. You can go to the OCAP website at www.ocap.ca, and you can click on OCAP Radio and follow the links from there. So that's it for OCAP Radio. I'd like to tell you first that you should come out on April 15th, 12 noon at Allen Gardens to our mass demonstration on Raise the Rates. And the next program is Vantana Al Barrio with host Maria Escobar. I'd like to thank techs Mark Brill, Susie Alvarez, and Deborah Hayes. And I'm Kelly Bentley, and I'm saying goodnight and talk to you later. La 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 la. Saturday's boys live life with themselves. Dream lots of beer and wait for half-time results. Afternoon tea in the lighter bar. Chat the girls, they dig it. Saturday's girls work in Tesco's and Woolworths. Wear cheap perfume cause it's all they can afford. Go to discos and do baby sham. Talk to Jane, bingo accents. La 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 la